I think the moment we're approaching is in many ways the most important in 500 years in human history, in looking at issues of how we govern ourselves, how we secure our world, how we support ourselves. All the very values that were unleashed by the Enlightenment, we're now putting them to the test.
Coming up on In Contrast, Robin Wright, a foreign correspondent in action. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Robin Wright is an award-winning writer for The New Yorker. As a foreign correspondent for several news organizations, she's reported from over 140 countries. She's the author of numerous books and is currently a fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Robin, let me start by asking you, you are both a historian and a journalist. You are trained as a historian, but you are known as a journalist. I'd like for you to connect the two. What is one and what is the other in you on a regular basis?
I'm both because I chronicle contemporary history. And I've been very fortunate in my life to have traveled with presidents and seen how history plays out, see how they make important decisions, see how they interact with foreign leaders. I've covered wars as they happen from the front lines. I've known some of the most infamous and some of the most famous people. I've interviewed people like Muammar Gaddafi or Uganda's Idi Amin, some of the leaders of apartheid in South Africa. I also traveled for 2 years with Pope John Paul II and interviewed Nelson Mandela, watched as he walked to freedom 27 years after he was locked up by the apartheid government in South Africa. So it's a wonderful combination of seeing the world, seeing this incredible moment in history play out from more than 140 countries.
Do you think that journalists should have some training in history and that historians should have some training in journalism because the two feed on each other?
Well, totally. Most journalists, the good ones for the big papers, will have degrees, whether it's in international affairs. People who cover the Supreme Court will have often law degrees or have studied the law. You have to have real expertise. Tom Friedman from the New York Times, an old friend of mine from the days we were in Beirut together, spoke both Arabic and Hebrew. So when he covered both the Middle East, the Arab world, and Israel, he could speak to people in their languages. He understood their cultures. So that's really important. The tragedy is, I'm not sure all historians know how to write. One of the great problems, I think, in America is that writing is not taught as an art or a skill as it is in Britain or in other Western nations. There's the illusion that the longer the sentence and the more multisyllabic words are used, the longer the paragraph, the better the writing, when in fact it's exactly the opposite. I always say tight is right, write short, write pithy, write to the point, write things people understand in one bite rather than compound ideas in a single sentence.
Did you become a writer of short sentences while training, or did that come to you before? How have you changed after writing so much?
I think absolutely I've learned how to write. You have to write for the eye as well as the brain. And how many of us read to the end of a long paragraph? Not many. I always say, dupe your reader and divide your paragraph in two, and then they're likely to read more of it. There are just lots of ideas in terms of keeping concepts to a degree that people can read them, embrace them, and remember them, not pile on ideas. And that's something that we're not taught. Unfortunately, in universities, people write quite dull prose.
You are known for your reporting on foreign affairs on all these many countries you were listing, particularly the Arab world in North Korea. I want to have you reflect on being a woman journalist in the Arab world, the challenges that you face and the way you go around it in order to get your sources, deliver the material in the way you want it delivered.
Well, I started in Africa and there were 106 members of the Foreign Press Corps and 105 of them were boys. It's not the Arab world, it's just breaking into foreign policy. It's in many ways the last frontier for females. When you look how long it took to get a female Secretary of State or a female ambassador to the United Nations, that there were so many impediments to women being taken seriously. As a war correspondent, I was always the only person there. I always had to put my life on the line more often just to prove that I was equal to the boys in covering a conflict. I've made a career of it now, and there are more women. One of the turning points was in Beirut in 1982 during the Lebanese Civil War, the Israeli invasion, the rise of Hezbollah, when a couple of male journalists were taken hostage. And so news organizations sent out women, not for any altruistic recognition that women were equally capable, but so there'd be less liability for news organizations, less likelihood that women would be taken hostage. But I also think that women bring something different to journalism, to covering foreign affairs. Because of our traditional roles, we often are good listeners. We often cover the human dimension of a story, not just how many have died, or where the front line is, or who has the biggest arsenal, but we look at the human toll of a conflict or a crisis. We understand the impact, whether it's on families, women and children, the refugee problem, and not from the point of view of just the toll on women. We don't cover it because we're feminists or because we happen to be female, but just because that is something that we've inherited through the millennia as our place in society, and so we're often more sensitive to those things. And frankly, I think it makes us better correspondents than a lot of the men.
Do you think that in Africa, in the Arab world, men will hesitate or do hesitate in talking to a woman correspondent, or will deliver whatever information, an anecdote, a story, a message in a different way because of who is receiving it?
Sometimes just the questions that women will ask. Everyone has a story to tell. And if you're a good listener, then they often will tell the story. I remember interviewing the head of Hezbollah, the Party of God in Lebanon. And we talked about the array of subjects that anyone would ask. But I also asked him how he came to be what he was. What were the incidents and the moments in his life? What role, whether it was in his childhood, whatever. And he told me an amazing story about how he was inspired by a cleric in Lebanon, to the point that when he was 9 years old, he borrowed his grandmother's black shawl and wrapped it around his head, pretending to be a cleric, and made his family pray behind him. And you just begin to see how people end up in whatever roles in society. And that doesn't justify anything that any of these people have done, because Hezbollah killed many Americans, killed many of my friends. I lived in Lebanon during the first suicide bomb ever against an American target, when Hezbollah bombed the U.S. embassy in 1983, and 6 months later blew up the U.S. Marine compound. I can still hear that bomb go off in my head, killing friends at both places. But what I wanted to do was find out who did it and why, and that's the historian in me.
Why is it that you became a journalist? How did you not follow the path simply of becoming a historian? Or what is it that brings you to those scenes, some of them very dangerous, and want to know the who and the why and the how come?
Well, ending up as a journalist was a total accident. Life is serendipitous. My father had only girls. He expected to have a son, and he loved sports. And I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where the University of Michigan has many very good sports teams. And my father, since I was the first child and the substitute son, would take me to football, basketball, and baseball games. We would talk about foreign affairs and who were the best football teams of all time or the first baseball teams over the dinner table every night. Those were the two great areas of conversation. So when I went to Michigan, one of my roommates was going off to join the University of Michigan Daily, then the largest paper in the country. Printed a paper every night, 32 pages. And I listened to all the editors talk about national coverage and political coverage and Michigan coverage. And then the sports editor gave his beginning of semester spiel. And I thought, revenge. I'm going to write one article to surprise my father and get back at him. And it turned out that I liked it. And I've been writing ever since. I was the first female sports editor of a student paper in the United States. And that prepared me, as the football coach liked to say at the time, for all the wars I covered afterwards.
Do you still occasionally write about sports?
I do. I did a piece just a year ago on the mania of Michigan football. We had a new coach named Jim Harbaugh. And the piece went viral, to put it mildly. And the New Yorker couldn't understand why Michigan football had such a big following. And I said, you don't understand Michigan football fans.
One of your recent books is Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. And it chronicles the Arab Spring, its various mutations over time, at the very beginning of the second decade of this century. And we are now coming close to that decade. The Arab Spring looks like history, looks remote, looks fossilized. The way the previous dictators and other strongmen look fossilized at the very beginning. There is a sense of an Arab Spring taking place in other parts of the world. How do you look back right now at that phenomenon in that part of the world?
Well, I ultimately am actually a little bit optimistic about the future of the Middle East. Immediately, it's going to get tougher, much messier, much bloodier than it is now. But down the road, the elements that produce the Arab Spring are still there. And there are a number of factors. One is that for the first time in history, you have the majority of people in the region literate. They may not have high school degrees, but they can read and write. And their education has enabled them to get beyond their village, their neighborhood. They have a sense of their country, their continent, and the change that's taken place elsewhere in the world. And they very much want to be part of it. And that really is striking. And along with that is the fact that for the first time, the majority of females, with one exception, are also literate. And when you bring females into it, that's over half the population in most countries. Look at Iran and Saudi Arabia, two Islamic societies, very different. But in both, more than 60% of the university student body across the country is female. And they're not studying history or the arts. They're in engineering and architecture and medicine and the hard sciences. And so they very much want to be part of society. So that's one component. Then you have another, which is the fact that you have the tools. And it's not just Twitter and social media. 20 years ago, we saw the emergence of Al Jazeera as the first independent satellite television station that provided news in the local language and outside state control. It revolutionized how people in the region saw their news. Today, you have over 500 independent satellite television stations in the region alone. And they have introduced the idea of diversity in a region where you saw dictators and a religion that advocated in its most devout form only one path and one truth. Today, you have different religious programs, different fatwas being issued by clerics, different soap operas, different news programs. Diversity is now embraced among a literate population, and those components change society. There are other elements as well. Demography, the fact that the majority are young. In Iran, for example, the majority of people have been born since the revolution. The majority of the electorate now has been born since the revolution, and that has changed the nature of who's elected president. Now, the problem was the Arab Spring was brought to us by people who suddenly recognized, hey, we have rights. They knew what they opposed, but they didn't know how to create an alternative. They didn't have the networks, the experience, the maturity, the resources, financial or societal or political. They didn't have the political parties to create alternatives. So that's still a long way, a generation or two down the road. But the fact is, they knew they deserved something better. And I think in many of these countries, the revolutions are still to come.
When I think of the Arab world, Robin, because I come from the Hispanic world, from Latin America, I become a skeptic. When people refer to Latin America, they look at a unity when we Latin Americans know how that unity is more a figment of foreigners thinking about the region than of the natives. So I wonder, is there really something called the Arab world? Is the Arab world already, with the diversity that you were talking about, fractured even beyond the concept that was prior to the Arab Spring? And hopeful as you are, is that also presenting dangers?
A lot of questions in there. But the bottom line is, I totally agree with you. There is an Arab world geographically, in the same sense there is a Latin America geographically. But the diversity within is extraordinary. We should not stereotype people, as we are prone to do as Americans. In the same way, there is not one American. We are all probably patriotic in our sense of we believe in America. But how we define America is quite different. And that's led to fracture in our own society. I don't think the Arab world is any different than anywhere else in the world right now, the identity politics. We're in one of those epic moments in history where we are inevitably moving to be something bigger. We've known since World War II and the aftermath that we need to be part of, whether it's an economic bloc, a security bloc, a global political bloc. So we've got NATO, or we did have NAFTA, but we have, there are other regional blocs that we are part of. We have trade blocs, and we're part of the United Nations, that we are moving to bigger entities, to bigger space, to different ways of making decisions about our security, our governance, our commercial and trade life. But we don't know how to do that. In the aftermath of World War II, we had the United Nations, and we created institutions. We had principles, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. What we're missing as we begin the process of globalizing are all of those key elements: leadership, direction, principles, institutions. And so what's happened in the void, because we're lacking leadership, not just from the United States, I mean globally, is that we are clinging to those things with which we identify and that give us a sense of safety. It's a little bit like a tornado. What happens when a tornado passes through? You race to the cellar and you cling to the pillars. They make you safe. We are in the midst of an historic tornado globally. And what are we doing? We're racing to the pillars of our soul and clinging to the ideas, the identity that make us feel safe, because that's what we know. We don't want to face the unknown without some sense of where we're going. And so for a while, whether it's in the Middle East, whether it's the United States, every country in the world, every community in the world is going to face these questions. And a lot of it will break down short term into identity politics until we get to the point that we are able to figure out how to think bigger, to rule bigger, to be part of something bigger without being afraid.
This is the counterpoint, maybe, of what globalism is about. Globalism is the effort to think of ourselves as part of a united or homogenized effort that is the globe itself. The counterside is that as a result, or maybe in response to globalism, we have also become much more tribal, what you're saying, much more identity-driven. And we have also gotten the sense that there is a certain development that every society needs to go through, and that it needs maturity. You're suggesting that it needs to have its institutions in place, that it needs to have visionary leaders. The view is that some of our societies that have gone already through that path can serve as a lesson as a model to other societies so that they come and follow that track again. I wonder, though, if there is a critique to be made also of that idea that all societies go through the same patterns and that democracies can come once things are established, or maybe that we're imposing on other societies the path that we have taken in the United States, the path that we have taken in Europe, in other advanced societies, open, democratic. I'm thinking in particular of W. Bush period of exporting democracy and bringing it to the Arab world or to Africa or Latin America. Do we run the risk of wanting, through journalism, through foreign affairs and politics, wanting everybody to look like us?
That's a big question, too. I don't know whether it's looking like us, clearly not physically, but there is an understanding that democracy takes many forms. European and American democracy is very different. Parliamentary versus presidential, executive presidential democracy. Democracy is going to take different forms because of different cultures in other parts of the world. And the problem is, what role should any country play in helping another? And clearly, the United States knows how to oust undemocratic regimes, but we have a proven track record now of not knowing how to create viable democracies. We tend too often to look for people who reflect our values, or, as someone once said to me about the Shah of Iran, that we looked for people who spoke English and had read Shakespeare and therefore thought that he was automatically an ally, however he ruled. And that we've been guilty of repeatedly, looking for those who will say they go along with us on certain issues, but who are not necessarily going to be any more democratic than the undemocratic regimes that we're replacing. That's been a consistent problem. People like to cite the Marshall Plan as something that, well, you know, the United States helped rebuild Europe and helped unify Europe, when in reality it was Europe with a huge loan from the United States that rebuilt itself, because it had the political maturity at that point, it had the developmental skills, the tangible tools to rebuild physically and politically their nations. The Marshall Plan is probably not a good model for what we do elsewhere, because not every society can. The United States has been so inconsistent in who we identify as a good ally that sometimes just beginning there in saying we want to look for countries that reflect our values. It may mean a period of slight instability, but it is worth going through the transition to build something that is bigger and stronger down the road.
Do you think we have the capacity to take a step back and really learn? We want others to learn from us. But as you're saying, we can destabilize, but we can't figure out how to stabilize or help others. And we jump into all the situations. We seem to be very impulsive to show that we have the might, but not the character. The question is less what others can learn from us than what we can learn of ourselves. And how do we contain and control?
One of our core problems is that with a president facing election every 4 years, that every president is going to look for what they can achieve in 4 years and doesn't want to set in motion a process that may take a generation or two to play out and will therefore be blamed for the instability that is produced from unleashing a transition. But the world is in transition, and we have seen over the last 40 years, and I've covered a lot of it, whether it's the end of military dictatorships in Latin America, the end of apartheid and minority rule in Africa, the demise of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, the end or the diminishing of the most odious ideologies in the world. But it's really hard to figure out how to replace them. The people on the ground have to do that. The one thing that I keep being reminded of from Ken Burns' great series on the Vietnam War is that bombs can destroy. They can eliminate regimes. But bombs do not create democracy. It takes something bigger. And it takes the legitimacy, local legitimacy. We can't give legitimacy to, in other countries, to leaders, unless they really have the legitimacy from their own people.
And what's the role of the journalist in all this? Is it an observer and a chronicler, the wonderful pieces that you write that allow us to see different perspectives? There's a part of Rock the Casbah that I personally felt excited. Simply the hip-hop rap kind of side of the Arab Spring, which we don't get. Should a journalist also be an activist quietly in not only educating, but in advancing certain values that either the regime or that are quietly embedded in our culture but are not being presented in a straightforward fashion? With the failure of historians that you were talking about, is the journalist now taking the role of bringing all the facts that the rest of us are not reading in history because history books can be so damn boring?
Activist, never. Educator, always. Mm. There's a big difference between the American and European press. The European press tends to be affiliated with one party, and there's no firewall between news coverage and opinion pieces, the editorial pages. In the United States, there is that firewall, so that when I was at the Washington Post, we never talked about positions. The editorial board and the foreign affairs reporters might go out and interview someone together, but we might come up with very different kinds of coverage. As a journalist, I would write what someone says. The editorial board will say whether it's good or bad or somewhere in between. But it's really important that we are on the ground. And the challenge for American journalism in the 21st century is that no newspaper has the resources or the ability to have the huge news operations in lots of different countries. The economics of journalism have changed so dramatically. A lot of times now you find young freelancers out covering wars because they're willing to. They don't get paid well. They may not have war coverage if they are injured. And you don't have the experienced war correspondents there who have a sense of the wider world and who covered wars before. And that, to me, is very discouraging. There are very few papers, I think, that are going to last long term. New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, USA Today, because they have very different audiences. It's a real struggle. For example, I've been a journalist all my life, and I do not subscribe to a single newspaper anymore. I don't get home delivery.
Is that because you read them online or because you don't read them?
No, I read online, but I also...
You have given up on print.
I've given up on print, and it was something I never thought I'd be capable of. But there are so many alternatives, and on Twitter, I can follow people who have links to stories, and the range of things I read now is much wider than ever.
Do you write differently when you write for online than when you write for print? Is there a different type of voice or approach or texture or granular view?
No, it's different whether I write for the, in the old days when I wrote for the Washington Post, or now I write for the New Yorker. And so now I can bring more of the human narrative into it, or the bigger picture, or something that I've covered personally that can offer some insight. I was on the front lines with ISIS in Mosul in March, for example, and I could write about what I saw, whether it was the retreat of ISIS or the fighting or the dead bodies still with suicide bombs on them. So I can bring that kind of color to a piece now that I couldn't necessarily in straight news coverage.
You were talking about Iran, and we are at a moment where the deal that was orchestrated through astonishing diplomacy by the Obama administration is crumbling and is going to mark the dividing of the waters. What is your view on the vision that is going to come within Iran of to trust or not to trust the United States if, as you were saying before, every time we have a regime change in this country, the idea that we had some deals before is not going to be taken seriously?
Well, first of all, the Iran nuclear deal, which I covered intimately, going both to Tehran and talking to the U.S. negotiators, as well as some of the other parties, was the most significant arms proliferation agreement in more than a quarter century. Whether you like it or not, it was significant. It dealt with the big issue of rogue nations gaining a nuclear capability, the same problem we face in North Korea today. It was striking that the United States and Europeans, with the Chinese and the Russians, all spoke with one unified voice at a time that the U.S. was in crisis with the Russians over Ukraine, where we had deep divisions with the Chinese over North Korea. And yet on this issue, we spoke with one voice. It set a precedent. It created a new model for diplomacy. The deal, like most every diplomatic achievement or every arms agreement, was not perfect. Everybody had objections to it, but it came closer and it won agreement on critical points, whether it was the immediate dangers of nuclear enrichment or the long-term dangers of creating a bomb that might in turn then encourage other Middle East countries in the world's most volatile region to also go after a nuclear program. And that was its importance. Clearly, the deal also set a framework for dealing with North Korea, because the reality is that we're not going to be able to convince the North Koreans to give up their nuclear weapons. And the Chinese are unwilling to do it for us because they want the North Korean regime to stay in power. They don't want the Korean Peninsula to be unified. They look at North Korea as a buffer for them against the West being on their doorstep. They don't want North Korea to have a bomb, but they're not going to be willing to take the steps that we want them to. It'll do a bit. It's already done a bit. It'll do a bit more. But the reality is the best scenario, and it's not one any of us want to accept, but the reality is, short of war, we may have to accept that North Korea is a nuclear power and then try to contain it, to freeze its program so it can't move any further, that it doesn't do any more of these very scary tests in unleashing missiles that could reach U.S. shores, or that it marries the last of three steps to get a nuclear weapon is marrying the missile, the delivery system, with the nuclear bomb itself. And that's the one we want to freeze in place.
Looking at it from this very present, from the moment in which we speak, certain events might have happened already. I wonder if it is the players who are on both sides, the irascible, impulsive, that seems to take this out of the hands of diplomacy and into the hands of the sandbox fight, where one has to prove who is more macho or who is more, who can enhance his reputation more. And it strikes me that North Koreans know so little about the United States. I was spending some time with some reporters that were able to spend a few weeks there. And the vision that people have in North Korea of the United States is a total abstraction. It's almost science fiction. And it's the same science fiction vision that we have of North Koreans. Here, we are not talking at each other. We are talking beyond ourselves with leaders that seem not to want to listen to the rest of us. So all that you're saying, Robin, paying attention to what we have been able to accomplish, the diplomatic achievement, the fact that we have to recognize that this is a nuclear power and work within that framework goes against the impulsiveness of the leaders that we have right now, which seems almost to defeat the very rationality of the entire effort. It seems that reason is the casualty here, the victim.
Well, I've been to North Korea, and I was on the only trip by a senior U.S. official since the end of the Korean War in 1953. I went with Madeleine Albright when she was Secretary of State to try to deal with the current leader's father. It is true, North Korea is a place that does seem like it's out of a science fiction book. My fear about the current situation is that neither side wants a war, but that the escalatory nature of the rhetoric, the threats, the tests, whether it's the North Korean tests or the fact the U.S. is flying bombers over North Korea or near North Korea, could trip us into a conflict, and that Kim Jong-un, the younger of the two leaders, would feel vulnerable. He's protecting, as he sees it, his country, his family's legacy, so forth. And that he may decide to use a weapon in response to some act that's really not intended to provoke them, because he fears losing them if he doesn't use them. And he wants to say, whatever you're going to do to us will come at a cost. It's the accidental war. And I actually wrote a piece for The New Yorker about what war with North Korea would look like. And it's one of the scariest pieces I ever wrote. And I've spent almost a half century now covering wars on four continents. So I'm used to the horrors of war. And the estimates by military commanders who've led both the U.S. and U.N. troops in the Korean Peninsula is that 100,000 people would die in Seoul alone. You could have 1 million casualties in South Korea alone. That once a war started, the U.S. would be taking out not just the nuclear facilities, but also the regime. Because as long as the regime is there, it's going to want a nuclear program to protect its people. And so the goal would be ultimately regime change. And that there would be two different phases of the war. The first phase, where the U.S. could bomb, as it did in Iraq, as it did in Afghanistan, destroy facilities, force regime change. But then you'd move into a second phase that would be an open-ended insurgency by people who, in North Korea, believe that the regime was the only thing that protected them. And that we could see, as we see in Afghanistan now, our longest war ever, fighting an insurgency. In Iraq, we left and we had to go back because of different kinds of insurgency. That North Korea could be more complicated than all of them at a tremendous cost. And remember, we have tens of thousands of Americans living there too, or tens of thousands more living in whether it's Guam or Japan, that this is a war that could have repercussions and cost not just the lives of our soldiers, but the lives of civilians as well. It should be a war that we do everything possible to avoid. And I'm not sure that either side shows any realism now about what it would take to avoid that war. And that's what scares me.
To wrap the conversation, when I read your work, and when I think of war correspondence, I think of the model of George Orwell visiting different sites and then coming back and reflecting occasionally on language. And that's where I want to bring you. I wonder if, having talked about being trained as a historian but being a journalist, say something about the English language, the words that you use every day, that you shape your pieces with. The endearment or refusal to use certain types of words. And what does that language do to you, given the fact that when you go out, it is the main ID card that you have?
Wow, that's really quite a question. I will tell you that all the decades I have been writing, that starting a piece still leads to sensations of terror and fear. And can I put that sentence together? Can I assemble enough of the ideas to really convey a place or a moment in history? And it's horrifying, terrifying. I go into very dark places when I write a book. It's something that after I finish every book, I swear, never another book. But there's also something so seductive about writing and communicating. And again, that privilege of witnessing history, I don't want it to be for nothing. Or putting my life on the line, I don't want that to be for nothing. And I want to help other people understand. Again, sometimes it's the human dimension. Sometimes it's the historic stakes of an event, a moment. I'm still writing at the end of my professional life and will until I drop. because I think the stakes are getting ever bigger. I think the moment we're approaching is in many ways the most important 500 years in human history in looking at issues of how we govern ourselves, how we secure our world, how we support ourselves. All the very values that were unleashed by the Enlightenment, we're now putting them to the test. And we're trying to figure out how we do it as one world. And particularly in a century where I think we will find epic discoveries in the universe that will address or answer the questions of whether we're alone. And we are really moving in extraordinary ways in the advancement of our knowledge of where we came from and what we're part of. And so it's very exciting, and I want to write about it until the moment I drop.
It's been an honor having you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
A good foreign correspondent is like a fox, astute, savvy, alert, and ready to camouflage. My idol is George Orwell. Although best known for the novels Animal Farm in 1984, among his best work is Homage to Catalonia, a first-hand account of the Spanish Civil War. It is a stunning exploration of the devastation of an armed struggle and a critique of communism when it wasn't cool to have such a stance. What makes Orwell's narrative perennial is that it oscillates between a personal account and a historical meditation. It balances the particular and the general, the local and the universal. Perhaps even more valuable is that it's an outsider's take. That's what a foreign correspondent does. They look at things with a critical eye. Because the correspondent knows little about the conflict, they can't be swayed in any direction. Ours is an age in which journalists are considered a threat. They are often targeted by the political elites because their narratives can offer depth and complexity, precisely what tyrannical leaders don't want. Among journalists, the foreign correspondent faces special hurdles. They need to get acquainted quickly with a place in which they most often don't even know the language. They need to be astute, savvy, and alert in order not to be manipulated. They need to blend into the environment so as not to exacerbate situations. And equally important, they need to be good writers. For only a good writer is able to offer depth and complexity, two attributes that foreign correspondents will tell you are learned not in school, but in the field and after years of experience. We frequently hear about foreign correspondents getting things wrong. Sure. That's inevitable. What we don't hear about as often is when they get things right. It is thanks to those times that we're all enriched. Through their stories, we become less parochial. Next time on In Contrast.
I kind of think we're entering a period like the 60s and 70s, which is a rough period to live through in a way. It's disruptive. It's unnerving. You worry that things could go very badly wrong in the country. We probably came out of it stronger than we were, and a lot of great things were accomplished.
William Crystal, next time on In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send us an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook. Our interns include Isabel Myers, Jacob Pagano, Ian Petty, Ushi Shao, and Brian Torres. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.